Shalom Havarim. Hello, friends. Good to be with you here on this lovely Sunday morning. Let's be honest. How many people here broke down this week? How many people turned on the heater? What did you think I was talking about? Okay. I'm not here to judge. We are here to love you. But I meant, like, how many of you actually gave in and turned on the heat this week? Just like 3-4 people. I'm not alone. Okay, yeah. So I went home on Friday. I was working in here, and it was like 64 degrees in the house. And I'm like, it's only going to get colder. So I went ahead and did that. That was the last day of September. I jumped the gun a little bit there. But of course, we got all of our sweaters out, our hoodies, things from the closet, things we hadn't worn for months. And I got one of the sweaters. It was brand new last year. I hadn't worn it. And I put it on, and it was just really staticky. Like, there was a lot of static electricity. You know what I'm talking about. The weather gets dry. You put those sweaters on. Your hair starts going everywhere. A lot of static electricity. So I decided I'm just going to take this sweater, and I'm going to return it. And they were able to switch it out for me with a new one, free of charge. Okay, all right. So I really did all of that except for switching a sweater out. It is a lovely day. I try to remember, though, we have to be happy for what we have, thankful. As gross as it is out, at least we are not in the middle of the hurricane like they were in Florida. We want to remember to keep Florida in our prayers and all those along the coast. Charleston, South Carolina, not West Virginia. My geography is bad, but my heart is in good places. So we want to remember to pray for all of those people today who are hurting. And also want to be thankful that we decided to meet outdoors last week instead of this week for church. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Excellent. Well, today we are continuing our sermon series on the martyrs. And I took a little break last week while we were out at the park. I didn't want to talk about the martyrs while we were out there in that beautiful location. But we're going to return to that topic today, and then next week we're going to conclude this sermon series by looking at some of the historical Anabaptist martyrs. I'm going to wrap things up early. We're not going to stretch it out all month. So next week you're going to hear some familiar names. If you come up in an Anabaptist tradition, it may be new to some of you as well. We're going to talk about people like Felix Mons and Conrad Grebel. Conrad Grebel is not a martyr, actually. I take that back. Michael Sattler, and of course, everyone's favorite martyr, Dirk Willems. You don't know Dirk Willems? Okay, well, come back next Sunday or listen to the video later. Dirk Willems, we'll make sure to touch on that as well. So next week we will conclude this sermon series. Today we're going to be looking at some 20th century martyrs. 2 weeks ago we looked at 21st century martyrs. We looked at M.J. Sharp and who else did we look at? Tom Fox, thank you. Where did that even come from? Nice, come on now. The pastor who preached on it and studied it didn't remember the name. And Tom Fox. And today we're going to be looking at Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Oscar Romero. And how appropriate was it that we sang a song in German the day we're studying Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Sehr gut. Herr Zent. Very good. And I have to be a little honest here. I should always be honest. But I'm going to be honest. Like, I don't have a lot of experience with Oscar Romero. Like, I know who he was. I know a little bit about his story. Mostly what I know him from are the various memes that you see. He was a very quotable person. He had a silver tongue. And we're going to go through some of his quotes here later today. I'll admit that I knew a lot more and know a lot more about Bonhoeffer. I studied with a Bonhoeffer expert in seminary. And actually, one of the best leading experts on Bonhoeffer is a professor at UVA right now, Charles Marsh. Is a leading expert on Bonhoeffer. And I've got this little bit of a fanboy attitude toward Bonhoeffer. He's one of my heroes in the faith. A couple years ago when I started studying German, we had to all get our own German names, you know? And I went by the name Dietrich. Yes, and I will even admit, I don't know if I should probably run this by my wife, I believe that I petitioned to have Paxton's middle name be Dietrich. Yeah, you could have been Patrick Paxton Dietrich Gosser. How powerful does that sound? So I am a bit of a fan of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. That will come out in this service today. And I started thinking about these two individuals, these martyrs from the 20th century. And you see that there's this common theme that runs through these stories. They were people who resisted those in governing authority positions, whenever the governing authorities were doing things that were outside of God's will. And I started thinking about different examples in the Bible of people who resisted the leaders of their days, whenever these leaders were doing ungodlike things. And it really wasn't hard to come up with a list of people. Like the first ones I think of are Shipra and Puah. Of course, everybody, the Shipra and Puah, right? These are the Hebrew midwives. They refused the order of Pharaoh to kill the Hebrew babies. We think of Daniel, we think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to bow down and worship an idol. Some were thrown into a fiery furnace, and God protected them. I think of people like Rahab, who didn't tell on the Hebrew people when they were in the city there. They didn't get ratted out by her. I think about people in the New Testament, people like Paul. How often was Paul arrested? This guy was always in prison because he kept going from town to town, city to city, talking about Jesus. The disciples themselves, many of them were martyred because they were evangelists going around and talking about Jesus. But then I came across this story, the story about Obadiah. And I forgot about this story of Obadiah. I know that I remember Elijah the prophet, but I forgot about this specific story. And I think that this is a story that needs to be told. So today we're going to look at Obadiah and Elijah and how they resisted the governing authorities of their day. And we're going to try to compare and contrast them with Oscar Romero and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Sound good? Excellent. Well, let's go ahead and get started by looking at this biblical story. So in the text that Cadron read for us, we have a number of individuals that are represented here. One of the people that we find is King Ahab. And King Ahab was king from, I think, 870 to 850 BC. So in that era, after King David lived, long before Jesus came along. And Ahab was known as kind of an unrighteous king. He married outside of the Israelite tradition. He married a foreign woman. And she brought her gods into Israel, and they became the gods of Israel. These gods were known as Baal and Asherah. Now, this woman is named in this text, and her name is Jezebel. Everybody knows the name Jezebel because it's a name that we sometimes use. I don't use it. We inclusively. It's a name that people sometimes use to talk about an unholy or unrighteous woman who is leading people away from God. And that's what's going on in today's text. Jezebel has led Ahab away from the faith of his forefathers, and they are now worshiping Baal and Asherah. So in this situation, we have this guy coming on the scene by the name of Elijah. Elijah was this outspoken prophet. He was kind of a little bit cocky. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have so much recorded about Elijah in our text. For instance, if you look just after our text, it's another thing I really should look at and preach on in the near future. I love this story. Elijah comes to the prophets of Baal and Asherah, and he challenges them to a sacrifice off. Like we might have a sing-off or a dance-off today. They're having a sacrifice off. So they set up these two different altars with two different sacrifices. It's hard to see here. There's one altar over here. There's one over there. And the gods of Asherah the prophets of Asherah and Baal are challenged to call fire down from their gods to consume this sacrifice. And this goes on for a period of time. They cry out louder and harder, and they make all sorts of noises, and nothing happens. And do you know what Elijah does? He laughs at them. He mocks them. He says, "Your gods must be sleeping. Yell louder." He's a little bit cocky. And instead, what he does then is he makes this circle around his altar. He pours water on the offering and then calls down fire from heaven after he's doused it in water and it lights up, and he shows them just how powerful his God is over the gods, the Baals, the Asherites. Like I said, he's kind of cocky, but it's interesting, isn't it? As you can imagine, this does not put Elijah in good standings with the king. And Jezebel, it says in the passage that Kadron read for us, at one point she tries to round up all of the prophets of Israel and have them killed. So this is this part where Obadiah comes into the story. As Jezebel is out there trying to kill off the prophets of Israel, Obadiah comes on the scene as well. Now, he is a fearer of God, it says in our text. He serves the Lord Yahweh. But he is also an employee at the palace. He kind of manages the day-to-day things. So he knows what's going on. He knows that Jezebel is putting this hit out on all of these prophets. So Obadiah rallies all these prophets of Israel together, and he finds places for them to hide. It says that he hid 100 different prophets. I didn't even know there were 100 prophets of Israel, but he finds these prophets, he gives them a place to hide, and provides them with food and water. So in the midst of all of this persecution of these prophets, Obadiah is out looking for pasture land for the animals of Israel. There's been a drought. And as he's looking for this pasture land, he comes up upon who else but Elijah. And he realizes that if he doesn't go back and tell the king that he ran into Elijah, that he will die. The king's going to find out about it. He's going to kill him for not turning in Elijah. And Elijah says, you know what? Let's go back and we'll talk to him together. Because I've got a few things to say as well. Like, I told you, he's cocky, but it's like there's something about that. And that's when they have this showdown, this battle among the different altars between the Baals and the Asherites and the God of Israel. Exciting story. I need to preach about that more and again here soon. What I want to do is I want to pause that story from the Bible for a minute and look at our 20th century martyrs for today. And the first person that I want to look at is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer was born in Germany in 1906. And you can see by the dates there that he didn't live very long. He lived to be 39 years old. Now, he was born into a very affluent family. He had money, and you always see him, he's dressed real nice in a lot of the pictures you'll see. And he was also brilliant. He got his first doctorate at 21 years of age. And I realized the other day, that's half my age. So when he was half my age, he was further along than me. Just saying. But he grew up in Germany, and he was a very religious person. What church would he have been a part of in Germany? He was Lutheran, yes. That's what I think you said. So in the Lutheran church, you could not be ordained as a minister until you were the age of 25 years old. He finished his PhD, or is it a DTH, something like that, a doctorate of theology at 21. He wanted to go into ministry, but he wasn't able to be ordained yet, so instead he just went to the United States and took a teaching position, because, you know, it's a nice second option. So in his early 20s, he goes to the United States. I think it's 1930 at this point. I should check that date. 1930, yes, he goes to Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And there he has a number of interactions with people. He grows in their relationship together, and it really influences how he thinks and how he lives. One person that he grows with in a relationship is Reinhold Niebuhr. And I sometimes have some negative things to say about Niebuhr, but he was a brilliant Christian ethicist and really had a lot to say and write about how the state and the church worked together and which one we were to essentially give our primary allegiance to. The other person that Bonhoeffer built a relationship with was a guy named Frank Fischer. Have you all heard of Frank Fischer? A little less famous than Reinhold Niebuhr. Frank Fischer was a fellow seminarian there at Union Theological Seminary, and he was an African-American man. So Bonhoeffer and Frank Fischer became best friends. And on weekends, this foreigner, this German, this resident alien, would go with Frank Fischer to church in Harlem. Now, can you imagine, like, he's you don't get much whiter than Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a tall, kind of thick German going into Harlem in the 1930s and joining them in worship. Like, sore thumb, right? Sticking out. But he was received in that community. He soon started teaching Sunday school classes at this church in Harlem. He was drawn to the African-American spirituals, and he was moved by their stories. And again, this was a rich guy in Germany. He came from this background with all these things. He always had things handed to him. And here he started to understand how different people had to live and live out their faith. And he uses this phrase, I think it's in a diary somewhere. He says that while he was there worshiping with the African-Americans in Harlem, in this oppressed community, that's where he experienced this move from phraseology to reality in his theology. It was no longer just about the words, but how he actually had to live them out. So Bonhoeffer, going to be a lot of history here. You ready for history? Bonhoeffer lived in New York for about 1 year. He was doing really what we call a postdoc. He was doing a postdoc at Union, goes back to Germany. Now, he begins as a professor of theology at the University of Berlin. And after a period of time goes by, he's old enough to be ordained. Sure. Goes to Alabama. Bonhoeffer drove through, okay, so I'm also going to bring up Karl Barth, and he drove through the area as well, but that's, anyway, so he drove right through the area. But then he goes back to Germany. The really important part is he drove through this area. he might have eaten at Rice Dairy. It's been there a while. Anyway, no, thank you for that. So he goes back to Germany. He starts teaching at the University of Berlin, and he's ordained as this Lutheran pastor. Now, 1933 is when the Nazi Party comes to power in Germany. And Bonhoeffer is, from day one, this outspoken critic of the Nazi Party. He called it the cult of the Führer, the cult of the president, the leader, who was, of course, Adolf Hitler. So 1933, I think just 2 days after Hitler comes to power, Bonhoeffer is giving this national address on the radio, because I guess he had that kind of authority and power and influence. So he's given this national address on the radio, and he's actually cut off mid-transmission because he is being critical of Hitler and the Nazi regime. Like, just like that. They just shut it off. No explanation. Nobody's exactly sure who cut it off. Was it the radio station themselves? The Nazi influence? Somehow, someone was scared enough that they were going to shut this down. That's 1933. Soon after, Bonhoeffer moved to London, and he pastored two different German-speaking churches. Now, the reason this is significant is because at that time, Karl Barth, who was a Swiss theologian who was also living in Germany, was very critical of Bonhoeffer's move because he saw Bonhoeffer as running away from the Nazi problem. It was easier for him just to go to be in Great Britain, to be a pastor at this church, rather than to be in the midst of it all and to be this outspoken critic of the Nazis. But while he was in London, Barth started or participated in something called the Confessing Church. And the Confessing Church was this kind of counter-movement against the Nazis. They held the Barman Declaration as their confession of faith. And the Barman Declaration says that Jesus Christ is the head of the church, not the Führer. Like, that shouldn't be that. All of us are okay like that. Like that fits our Mennonite theology. Jesus Christ is the head. But this statement right here, this was written by Karl Barth, and it got Karl Barth thrown out of Germany. He had to go back to Switzerland. Now, when Barth was thrown out of Germany, Bonhoeffer went back to Germany and started picking up the place that Barth had left off. I'm thinking, I might get them mixed up, sorry. Barth and Bonhoeffer are very similar names. They're not, they both start with B. But he goes back to Germany, and Bonhoeffer starts these underground seminaries. Like, how cool is that? Like, they met in secret to study the teachings of Jesus, the radical teachings of Jesus about his love, about the Sermon on the Mount, and things of that nature. And it's during this time that he writes probably his best-known book. It's called The Cost of Discipleship. And this is the one that we often hear quoted. It's actually like a 4 to 5 page long section where he talks about cheap grace. And if anybody wants to borrow a book, I have Cost of Discipleship and a few others by Bonhoeffer. But here's kind of the well-known passage from this time. Bonhoeffer writes that cheap grace is the grace we bestow on ourselves. Cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance, baptism without church discipline, communion without confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ living and incarnate. So he was saying that what he saw there in Germany when the people were going along with the Nazi regime, that was just the cheap grace. Well, I'm saved. I'm good. I don't need to worry about all of this. He's saying, no, grace requires more of you. So Bonhoeffer continued to be a part of this critical mass that critiqued the Nazi regime. And eventually, you know, he started participating in these events where they would move Jews out of Germany to Switzerland for their safe passage. Does that sound familiar? It sounds kind of like Obadiah. So he's moving them into safety. And eventually Bonhoeffer is arrested. And he's in the prison for 2 years. And then he is condemned to death by hanging because he is believed to have been a part of a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler. Now, this next part is a little bit questionable. Not everybody would say that this seems factual, but this is a quote from a doctor who was in the concentration camp where Bonhoeffer was killed, where he was hung. And this is his quote from the last minutes of Bonhoeffer's life, his account. He says, I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer kneeling on the floor, praying fervently to God. I was most deeply moved by the way this lovable man prayed, so devout and so certain that God heard his prayer. At the place of execution, he again said a short prayer and then climbed the few steps to the gallows, brave and composed. His death ensued after a few seconds. In the almost 50 years that I worked as a doctor, I have hardly ever seen a man die so entirely submissive to the will of God. I have the date included there, the date of his death, April 9th, 1945. And the reason that is so significant is because less than 1 month later, Germany would give up. He could have been a free man. So that, my friends, is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Well, let's move then to this other guy. And I have to bring up that picture. I love that picture. This is a guy known as Oscar Romero. And he just seems like a guy you want to hang out with, doesn't he? Oscar Romero was born the year 1917, and he lived until March 24th, 1980. And I realized that he would have been born the same year as my grandfather, and he died less than 3 months after I was born. And, yeah, actually, Cadron, you're March 1st. So 3 weeks after you were born was the death of Oscar Romero. So Oscar Romero was born in El Salvador. And I put the map up there because most of us, if you're like me, are bad at geography. El Salvador is in Central America on the south side of the, it's not an island, peninsula, Isthmus. Merry Isthmus to you too. El Salvador is on the bottom of the Isthmus there. So the neat thing about Oscar Romero, there's a number of things that are neat about him, is that at the age of 13, he entered the seminary because he decided he wanted to be trained to be a priest in the Catholic Church. And how many people out there knew exactly what they wanted to be at the age of 13? I can imagine a young Lowell Wanger saying, I want to be a respiratory therapist at 13, right? No, like, I didn't know. I wanted to be a professional basketball player at 13. That turned out. So he went into the seminary at 13, and then he started into various congregational ministries after that. He served in churches until he was named a bishop. And then in 1977, he was named the Archbishop over the country of El Salvador. He was centered in the city of San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. I do know that one. All right, the capital of San Salvador. Now, this was 1977, and some of you that are a little older than me might remember some of the issues that were going on in El Salvador at the time. There was extreme discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots, the landowners and the workers, extreme poverty at the time. A few other things. There was a decade-long civil war taking place in El Salvador. You might remember Jimmy Carter sending, I think, funds and guns and ammunition to El Salvador to help participate in the violence there. There was this rise of the paramilitary government. And during this time, approximately 75,000 Salvadorian people were killed or disappeared. They just would, well, the families would wake up and their family members would be gone. So all this is taking place in the 70s. And at first, Romero comes on the scene, and he's this conservative priest, and people liked him. He's articulate. He's a good speaker. But he wasn't one that would cause a lot of issues in the community. He wasn't one to ruffle any feathers. But a few months after Romero took the position as archbishop, one of his best friends was assassinated. His friend's name was, it's listed here somewhere, Rutilio Grande. So Grande was assassinated for his own work with the poor. And this made Romero decide that he was going to use his platform as the archbishop to speak out against those in power who are abusing their power, who are torturing people, who are killing them for their positions. Now, one of the things that Romero was able to use was this new technology known as the radio. And it sounds weird to us today, but like his radio sermons on Sunday morning were listened to by huge portions of the country of El Salvador. You go into the rural parts of the country, and I'm not sure how they came up with this number, but 73% of the rural population listened to his sermons on a Sunday morning. And 47% of the urban population listened to his sermons on the radio. I'm guessing a large number of people came to watch him in person as well. And I think that definitely beats out my three people that are watching right now online. This huge population, because he was this very articulate person. And I'm going to show you a few of these quotes from Romero that I found to be helpful. And you can see his theology here. Again, he's a very conservative person, but he also sees the humanity in all human beings and wants to fight and argue for the least of these among us. So we see things like this in Romero's work. He says, if we are worth anything, it's not because we have more money or more talent or more human qualities. Insofar as we are worth anything, it's because we are grafted onto Christ's life, his cross and resurrection. That is a person's measure. He says there's no dichotomy between man and God's image. Whoever tortures a human being, whoever abuses a human being, whoever outrages a human being, abuses God's image. He says each time we look upon the poor, on the farm workers who harvest the coffee, the sugar cane, or the cotton, remember, there is the face of God, face of Christ. I like this one. It says, there are many things that can only be seen through eyes that have cried. Let us not tire of preaching love. It is the force that will overcome the world. I don't want to be anti against anybody. I simply want to be the builder of a great affirmation, the affirmation of God who loves us and wants to save us. And I like this one too. Well, I like them all. The word of God is like the light of the sun. It illuminates beautiful things, but also things which we would rather not see. And how about this one? I'm going to end right here with this one. He says, I do not believe in death without resurrection. If they kill me, I will rise again in the people of El Salvador. So here he is, these popular Sunday morning sermons broadcast throughout the country, and he is ruffling some feathers now. People are taking note of what he's saying. He's calling out the powers that are being abused by the people in positions of leadership. And at one point, the radio station at the church was bombed because of his message. Can you imagine that today? Somebody come in here and blow up my camera. We don't like what you're saying. We're going to blow it up. You can see how much of a threat it was to the people in power. And one of the things that was very threatening is that he humanized these deaths, these tortures, and those who were being disappeared. He started this practice of every Sunday morning reading the names of the people who were being tortured, reading the names of people who had been killed, reading the names of people who had disappeared. So no longer was it this anonymous force, this anonymous people. No, it was Jose. It was Leticia. It was Yolanda. It was these individuals from their community that you might have known personally. All right, so they blew up his radio station, but they did build it back, and they continued to broadcast. And then on March 24th, 1980, Romero preached his last sermon. He was in the church giving this sermon at a chapel alongside the hospital where he lived as a part of the community there of priests. And as he gave his last sermon, he finished the sermon, he stepped just to the side of the pulpit, kind of like I'm standing here now. And a single car drove in front of the door of the church. The door was wide open. It's hot. It's El Salvador. And a red car comes up. A single man gets out of the car, shoots a single shot, and kills Romero there in the front of the church as he finishes preaching that morning. The eerie thing is that, remember that all his sermons were broadcast. This is recorded. And it wasn't hard to find. Go on the internet. You can hear his final words, the sound of the gunshot that killed him, a pause, and then the screaming of the people of the church. Romero's last words, I'll give you one more quote from him, were, "May God have mercy on the assassin." I don't think it's hard to see how we can go from the stories of Elijah and Obadiah, these people that spoke truth to power, that called out the king Ahab whenever he was worshiping idols, whenever he was abusing the people of Israel, and Obadiah whenever he hid those priests in the cave, those 100 priests, and provided for them the food, the water, the sustenance that they needed. To go from that to these stories of Bonhoeffer, this person who spoke out against the Nazi regime, and Oscar Romero, who broadcast his understanding of the gospel across the airwaves. We see people willing to stand up for the poor, the weak, and the marginalized, even whenever it may cost them their own life. My prayer for us today is that we will follow their example. And I pray that none of us have to go to the extreme that they did. But I pray that we too will not find cheap grace to be sufficient. And we will not simply say, yes, we are saved, and that's enough. No, we will work for God's kingdom.